Welcome to the latest episode of Warships Pod, and we have a action-packed, busy itinerary or agenda for a conversation with Dr. James Voss Botanis and Dr. Gary Blackburn. Welcome, gents.
Thank you, Ian.
Hello, Ian. It's good to be joining you and Gary again.
And to kick things off, I think what would be useful, as we're being very newsy in this episode, is to look at a developing situation in Latin America, where Venezuela is setting up to do a bit of a Putin and annex part of Guyana. And I just wondered if you have any thoughts about the general situation there and how that might affect the global strategic position of, let's say, the West versus the axis of resistance, whatever we want to call it. And also, James, maybe you could give us some insight in particular on this, on how the naval forces stack up and what could or could not happen or may not happen or will happen off the coast of Guyana and Venezuela.
Oh, it's certainly a very interesting situation developing. Notably, there's a common thread running through this crisis and the crises in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, and that is Venezuela's relationships with Russia and Iran. Iran and Russia both supply Venezuela with various weapon systems, and the Russians have certainly been expressing a lot of interest in Venezuela for at least the past 15 years, with looking to base forces there to counter US missile defense deployments. In terms of the current crisis, the Guyanese have a very, very limited self-defense force. They have about 5 patrol boats and a handful of transport aircraft and helicopters. They have no fixed-wing combat aircraft or armored forces in their army against the Venezuelan military that has fast jets, at least one submarine, a couple of frigates, and various other things. So it's quite similar to August 1990 and Saddam versus Kuwait. You know, you have a quite formidable regional military power looking at its neighbour and thinking, I'm going to take a chunk of them.
And Gary, what's your perspective?
Yeah, I'd agree with James's summary there, but I suppose another angle to add perhaps is the implications of all this for the United States in geopolitical terms. Because one of the oldest geopolitical concepts is, of course, the Monroe Doctrine. And this is the notion that the United States will not put up with any other great power interfering in its own backyard. And as James says, because Venezuela has close connections with Russia and Iran and to some extent China as well, and because it is communist also, it will be taking the side of Guyana, as is Brazil. I guess the issue is, well, what to do? And I think what we've seen recently in the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf is the superb capability of navies to deter and prevent escalation. And so all eyes on Washington, I think. I mean, you could argue, let's look at London as well. Obviously, Guyana is a part of the British Commonwealth. I mean, ironically enough, the English cricket team are in the West Indies at the moment, and Guyana is part of the West Indies cricket team as well. So it'll be interesting to see how London responds to this and whether or not the Royal Navy and the United States Navy act. So I think that's another kind of really important angle to this breaking news crisis.
Yeah, well, until recently, I think, earlier this year, and in fact, I'm not sure exactly what the status of the warship is at the moment, but Britain did have the Royal Navy destroyer HMS Dauntless out there on the Caribbean patrol. But I believe she may have started on her return voyage to the UK. So having had a very useful air defence destroyer with very sophisticated sensors and some weaponry, UK no longer has that because there was no handover, I don't think, to another vessel of that merit, or should we say capability. But usually it's HMS Medway, which I believe has been somewhere else, which is why Dauntless has been there. And she's an offshore patrol vessel, only lightly armed with a cannon, but with a very sophisticated command and control system. So The UK has very little there. The Dutch have got warships there as well. But on the Venezuelan Navy, we did have a profile of their fleet in the magazine a few editions back by Santiago Rivas, who's based out there in Latin America. And basically, there's probably doubts over their submarine. Their frigate force has declined precipitously to one frigate that may or may not be able to go out. But they do have some Spanish-built offshore patrol vessels, a quartet of them, that have been upgraded and have received missiles and some more weaponry. But the most interesting thing is the up to seven, I believe, fast attack craft supplied by Iran, which has also supplied drones that can attack things, similar to those which we've seen in action against Ukraine and now used by the Houthis over the Red Sea. And those fast attack craft have not only missiles, but also can launch torpedoes, reportedly. So they probably are the most formidable aspect of the Venezuelan Navy, which is in a fairly ropey state, apart from, let's say, the fast attack craft and the offshore patrol vessels. And then the other thing that struck me, the visit or the links with the Russian Navy. The Russian Navy did send back in, I think, 2008 or 2009, a task group with the Peter the Great nuclear powered battle cruiser and also at least a destroyer. So they, and I believe, and maybe you can correct me on this, I believe the Gorshkov has also paid a visit to Venezuela as well.
I know the Gorshkov went to the Caribbean. I cannot remember if she visited Venezuela. But it's certainly a factor, I think, that cannot be ignored. It would work for Russia very nicely if there was now to be a crisis in Latin America, one that if the United States did have to respond to would inevitably draw away US naval forces from potential other regions such as the Eastern Mediterranean and the Middle East. But there was also another, albeit non-naval development, but it was recently announced that Belarus will be selling the Polonez M long-range rocket system to Cuba. So there's potential for Latin America to start getting more interesting geopolitically again.
Gary, it's interesting to see something James suggested there, is it adds another dimension to the global situation which favours Russia. So with Ukraine, the war bogged down there into the winter stalemate, and you've got the Houthis firing missiles and also sending drones over the Red Sea and having to be countered by the US Navy with its destroyers, and an uncertain situation there with, you know, are they deliberately targeting US Navy warships, or are they firing missiles and things in their direction whilst actually targeting merchant vessels? And then we have the Iranians more aggressive in the Strait of Hormuz on the other side of the Arabian Peninsula. And we have also possibly assisting Russia in putting more stress and strain on the West on all sorts of levels is, of course, the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. So are we seeing Russia... can we see the fingerprints of Russia and sort of pulling the strings along with their friends, the Iranians, across the world in a sort of, is it any kind of a coordinated strategy, do you think?
I mean, that's hard to say, to be honest, but I do think the stars have aligned somewhat for the Russians. I mean, it wouldn't be surprising if they were, you know, acting behind the scenes, not only in those territories, but also in obviously Africa as well, West Africa in particular. So I think the problem for Britain and America is overstretch. So the United States is faced with this sort of nightmarish situation where they're holding the line in the Middle East to make sure it doesn't spill over into a wider conflagration. They're providing a lot of military aid and financial aid, material aid to Ukraine. And then obviously in the background is the potential for conflict with Taiwan. And a lot of people are looking at the Taiwanese election in 2024 and wondering what effect that might have. And equally, the United Kingdom, obviously we've got assets in the Baltic. We've got assets in the Norwegian Sea. Prince of Wales was training out in the Western Atlantic. There's the deployment to the Eastern Mediterranean, Persian Gulf. On it goes. And it just sort of it feels like a perfect storm of events, actually. And of course, there are more allies than just the UK and the US. But I can't help but feel that we need a little bit more in our arsenal to deal with all these, these concurrent threats.
Turning to James and your specialist area, which is weaponry and missiles and things. Do you think the Houthis actually have the capability to fire, let's say, a ballistic missile and hit a warship? Do you think they've got that? Have they got the weaponry and everything else they need?
Yes, the Houthis have a range of anti-ship ballistic and cruise missiles, which they've been supplied with by Iran. There was a parade in September in the capital, Sana'a, on the 21st of September this year, and that showed some Iranian supplied weapons, which an analyst of the IISS has gone through in some detail. There was a few anti-ship ballistic missiles with ranges in the hundreds of kilometers, and some cruise missiles, including one cruise missile with a range of up to 800 kilometers. The Houthis also have the C-801 and C-802 Chinese-made anti-ship cruise missiles, which is a subsonic weapon with a range of just over 100 kilometers. So they operate a mix of systems. Whether they have the supporting kill chain in place to be able to conduct complex, larger scale strikes against ships operating in the Red Sea or the Gulf of Aden remains to be seen. I mean, the activity we've seen so far from the Houthis seems to have been quite small scale, with just small numbers of missiles launched against a handful of ships. So whether that is a deliberate nuisance strategy or a reflection of their limitations, it is uncertain.
So when you say the kill chain, just for people who are not perhaps as up to speed on things like that, what does that mean with regard to the Houthis and their missiles, their ballistic missiles, anti-ship ballistic missiles?
Yeah, the kill chain is are those intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance assets that enable you to find a ship, fix its location and track it and engage it. So obviously a ship is a moving target, and in the time it takes for a ballistic missile to be launched, cover a few hundred kilometers, the ship is going to move. So you need to have assets that can track that target and provide the ballistic missile with the necessary mid-course guidance updates, so that when the missile is in its terminal phase, approaching the target, its sensors that are on board know where to look and prosecute the target effectively. Because otherwise, just a error of several hundred meters would be enough for the missile to fall in the sea rather than actually strike the target.
Okay, so with regard to the specifics there, there have been merchant vessels hit with missiles, and also supposedly missiles fired in the direction of US Navy warships. So how are the Houthis achieving that ability to even get anywhere near those vessels, in particular hit the merchant ships? Are they using Iranian supplied drones, do you think?
It certainly looks like the weapons they are using are Iranian supplied cruise missiles, ballistic missiles and drones.
Right, so Gary, what do you think to the whole situation out there with the way that the US Navy and the Western nations, let's say, and those nations that have ships in the Red Sea and might be worried about them being attacked? How do you see it geopolitically? How are they playing it? Should they go in all guns blazing and wipe out the Houthi launch sites and do all that? Or are they doing the right thing at the moment in sort of holding back and just shooting down drones and also missiles that are outbound?
Well, I think they're doing the right thing for now, but I'm not quite sure how long they can keep showing that kind of restraint. I know we're going to talk about whether or not there's a comparison with the tanker war in the 1980s. I feel that at some point they're going to have to strike targets on land. because there's always the real risk that a missile could get through and damage or even sink an American warship, which would lead to a massive escalation anyway. So this might be an example of having to, you know, temporarily escalate in order to de-escalate. So, I mean, obviously the American warships have performed superbly, but they might have to kind of rethink their tactics if this is an ongoing event. And looking at some of the data, I looked at some of the data earlier in terms of how many missiles I couldn't find a number for how many ballistic missiles the Houthis have, but as of 2021, they'd fired 430 at Saudi Arabia. So they clearly have substantial stockpiles, you know, be it from Iran, be it based on North Korean designs. And they're not the most accurate weapons in the world, but some models are more accurate than others. And of course, they have hit some of the merchant vessels. So I think the Americans may have to actually be a bit more proactive in their strategy eventually. I think for the world generally, again, it illustrates just how dependent the world is on the United States Navy and on the mercantile trade. 12% of all the world's trade goes via the Red Sea. The insurance costs are rising quite substantially. I think they've gone up from something like, the premium's gone up from something like 0.05% of the value of the vessel to 1%. And some insurance policies are no longer available. And in a world of very high inflation, that's obviously not good news at all. So that's the other point, I think, that we should remember about the Red Sea actions, is that it underlines that navies and economies are attached at the hip in a way that armies and air forces and economies are not. Particularly so if you're an island state, largely dependent on trade, as is the United Kingdom. I think it's a figure, about 60% of our GDP is dependent on trade in one form or another. So, I mean, all of these, to be honest, all of these recent events massively underline everything that you read about in the naval textbooks. So if this is a great period in a way to address the issue of sea blindness, because, you know, all the actions we're seeing really underline just how significant naval power actually is.
Yeah, I mean, talking about the response, there's been discussion now, or it's been put out there by the spokespersons of the US government that there's going to be some kind of multinational naval task force considered, similar to the one that is also being run by the Europeans in the Strait of Hormuz, in the Arabian Gulf, the Persian Gulf itself. But there are multiple task groups out there, including one for counter-piracy, and there was certainly one for counter-terrorism. So there's plenty of working together with multinational navies going on. But I suppose it's a case of, do you have the will to take on what is probably the most serious threat to merchant shipping, and actually warships too, since the tanker war of the 1980s, when missiles were fired, warships hit mines, and there were mines were set adrift, as well as air attacks taking place by both the Iranians and the Iraqis in the Gulf, because they were at war with each other, and one side didn't like the other, had receiving help from the West and bank loans from the Gulf states. So it did take a while for nations to get their act together and stage, you know, escorts for merchant vessels in the Gulf. And I mean, it was there were fewer than 50 merchant ships were attacked in the Gulf between 1980 and 1983, and nearly 80 would fall victim to attacks in 1984. But it still took quite a while to get the whole process sorted out. So do you think, as it isn't quite the same scale as the tanker war at the moment, that they might move quicker to stop that happening with that many ships being taken out?
So looking at the tanker war's data, you know, the survival rates were actually pretty good. Quite a lot of ships were hit, but only 23% of the tankers were either sunk or completely written off. I think in terms of what's happening today, then my sense is they'll have to move fairly quickly, just because we're living in a very high inflation economy, and the effect of that is obviously very negative in terms of global growth. So they will have to move fairly rapidly. The only power that I think really benefits from this, I mean, you could argue that Hamas obviously benefits from this, but Russia, being obviously a net heavy producer of hydrocarbons, is obviously going to see those hydrocarbons rise in value if there's any dislocation to the trade. So it actually might be a circumstance where most of the other great powers' interests align. I'm thinking of China here, which is obviously net dependent on flows of hydrocarbons. So obviously there was a recent summit in San Francisco between Biden and Xi, and one of the outcomes of that was the agreement that their two militaries should start speaking to one another again.
So James, have you looked at all into any kind of comparison between the tank war of the 1980s and today, what's happening in the Red Sea?
No, it's not actually something I have looked at, but I think there's a comparison here that the tank war, obviously, it was Iran and Iraq. And again, we're seeing an Iranian-backed, Iranian-equipped proxy causing disruption in a strategic shipping lane. And I would expect that Tehran is quite confident that whilst Western powers might deploy an enhanced naval presence to the region to protect shipping, that would be more token than anything. After all, no one is going to want to intervene in Yemen to actually suppress the Houthi threat in a meaningful manner. Plus, the presence of Western warships would give the Houthis more chance to perhaps attempt some form of attack on a Western warship. We've so far not seen the Houthis employ their full range of capabilities, but on previous occasions, for example, in 2016 and 2017, they utilized unmanned surface vessels in attacks on shipping, as well as mines, as well as attacks using air cruise missiles. At the moment, we're seeing attacks with aerial drones, cruise missiles, reportedly anti-ship ballistic missiles, but we haven't seen the whole range of capabilities employed yet in a complex attack. And certainly if Iran wants to send a message via its proxies in Yemen, in the same way that it's sending messages in against US forces based in Iraq and Syria, that complex, painful attacks can be launched, then the possibility that some form of more serious attempt to target a US warship, for example, could be on the cards. I'm not sure whether such an attack would actually succeed, but it would certainly escalate tensions and cause political problems in Washington, where there seems to be a concerted effort by the administration to avoid escalating tensions any further in the Middle East, and particularly with Iran and its proxies. So it could be seen as something that might be a victory for the so-called Axis of Resistance if it could target a US warship and get away with it, as it were.
And that Axis of Resistance is Iran across through to Syria and down to Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas, and that's a resistance to the Israelis and the Western, you know, backers of Israel, or the Western intervention in the Middle East. Yeah,
I mean, this ultimately does go back to the 1980s. In the latter stages of the Iran-Iraq war, the Iranians got themselves into a fight with the US Navy, Operation Praying Mantis, and they came off very much worse for wear in it. And realizing that conventional naval operations stood no chance against the US Navy, the Iranians have invested significantly in asymmetric means as part of a wider conventional asymmetric strategy. And that is seen through the so-called Axis of Resistance. Iran's proxies in Lebanon, Hezbollah, Hamas, the different groups in Syria, Iraq, the Houthis in Yemen, combined with Iran's own ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drone programs. It's essentially a strategy whereby Western conventional military supremacy is offset by threats to the two key choke points, for Bab al-Mandeb and the Straits of Hormuz.
One thing that has popped up in people considering this, the naval situation today in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, is the fact that the Chinese have warships, supposedly at least one, possibly two, because they've got a forward operating base of sorts in Djibouti. So I don't think we've heard anything about them intervening to protect shipping. So I don't know if you want to comment on this, James, but are they sitting back and just seeing how it develops before they decide whether they'll join in protection of merchant vessels?
It's interesting. One can assume that perhaps as Chinese ships have not been threatened, the Chinese are not sending ships to the area. Alternatively, because the Chinese have maintained a careful diplomatic balancing act over the past decade or so between Iran and Saudi Arabia, they've wished to maintain good relations with both countries, and a neutral position when it comes to local conflicts, which of course helped earlier this year when they brokered an Iran-Saudi Arabia rapprochement. That if they were seen to now intervene against the Houthis, that would then be taking a side. And of course, the Houthis are a proxy of Iran, and so it would be disturbing the entire relationship that China has built up with the Iranians. So there could be a number of explanations here as to why the Chinese have not deployed any ships up in response to the Houthi attacks. I would expect it is a combination of wider geopolitical concerns combined with the lack of threat to Chinese ships.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the Saudis there, but of course the Houthis in the civil war in Yemen have been at war as such with Saudi Arabia, firing missiles into Saudi Arabia, attacking Saudi Arabian vessels off the coast. That's been going on for years. So I suppose what you say there about not wishing to upset Iran, who supply the Houthis with their weaponry, and also stay on the good side of Saudi Arabia is what you mean there, isn't it? That they realise it's a very complex, interwoven thing. So they're taking a very pragmatic view of it. And so until they're shipping Chinese flagged or other interests in merchant traffic are directly threatened, they're not going to get involved in the firing line. Is that what you're suggesting?
Indeed, and as per the agreement earlier this year, the Houthis are not supposed to be targeting Saudi Arabia, although there have been reports that some of the attacks intercepted since the October 7th attacks on Israel, some of the attacks launched by the Houthis possibly transited Saudi airspace on their way to attempted strikes on Eilat and other targets in Israel. So I think, to put it very simply, the situation with the Houthis is extremely complex.
Yeah, I mean, people, you hear the name Houthis and you see their inspection of that merchant vessel that they seized, which came ahead of the direct sort of attacks on merchant vessels, and their statements, which seem quite wild. And you do think they're maybe the fall guys for the Iranians in undermining the West and attacking the Americans in the way, as you suggested, that they have been using their proxies to attack the American forces on land in Iraq and in and around Syria. So Britain is a nation that's kind of stood back a little bit from the Gaza-Hamas war, in that we hadn't committed any any significant major warships to seize off the Levant, off Israel and the Lebanon, and have just sent the RFA Argus, which is an aviation training ship, but fulfilling a role at the moment as a sea base for Royal Marine Commandos and also Royal Fleet Auxiliary Landing Ship, which are not for war fighting. They're there for disaster relief and humanitarian aid missions to evacuate people if needs be from places, and also just to carry out general maritime security if that spilled over into the sea. But as we referred to a little bit earlier, the Royal Navy has Type 45 destroyers with the situation in the Caribbean, where Dauntless is coming back home. The Royal Navy has also had HMS Duncan, a Type 45 destroyer in the Mediterranean, stood back from the immediate crisis zone, working with the NATO task group. But now HMS Diamond has been sent through into the Red Sea zone. So there's now a risk, I guess, that HMS Diamond might be called on to protect some British flagged or owned vessels against attack by Houthi missiles. So do you think, without getting too technical about it, that the Type 45 will be able to integrate with the US Navy's multiple Arleigh Burke-class destroyers that have been in the firing line so far?
The Royal Navy and US Navy obviously work together very closely, and they've on previous occasions, a Royal Navy destroyer has integrated into a US carrier strike group. So I don't think interoperability is going to be a concern. And I think that in terms of the limited attacks of the Houthis so far have been prosecuting, then one of our Type 45 should be able to contribute to defending against that very proficiently. Were the situation to deteriorate and larger scale operations be undertaken and the Houthis launch more complex attacks, perhaps involving not just an anti-ship ballistic missile or an anti-ship cruise missile or one of these small, slow drones, but were to integrate the three together into a more complex multi-vector attack, that could be more challenging, especially as the surface-to-air missile capacity on a Type 45 is somewhat more limited than on an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer. But overall, I think, you know, should the need arise, the Type 45 should make a very good contribution to any defensive operations.
Thank you for listening. And if you want to know more about events in the Red Sea, including the Houthis firing missiles and also drones, please take a look at the January 2024 edition of Warships International Fleet Review magazine, which is in the shops and then rolling out globally from the 15th of December. But if you're lucky, you might find one out there already. And there'll be more from Gary Blackburn and James Botanis and myself in the next episode, when we look at the UK's so-called defence spending black hole, and also whether or not the UK's politicians have really woken up to the fact that we're facing a dangerous new Cold War. For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at warshipsifr, and also Twitter at warshipsifr. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.